head was still buried in the laptop. I know nothing about it, I said. Crespin nodded.
You're not alone. And what little the public does know about this building is because we want them to know it. But does that make it true? On Wikipedia, for instance, it says that every wall in this place is wrapped with an ultra-thin copper shielding that prevents all electromagnetic signals from getting out.
Okay, I'll take the bait.
Is that true? I asked.
It must be, he said. I read it on the internet.
Valerie, still fixated on her laptop, smiled. She was listening the whole time.
Note to self, the NSA is always listening.
Crespin took his seat back at the table. I wasn't sure what exactly he was talking about, although I got the feeling that was by design. He continued.
You see, people like to say that information is power. But inside these walls, copper shielded or not, we like to say something else. The real power? It's not information. It's misinformation.
As if on cue, Valerie leaned back in her chair. Whatever she'd been doing, she was done.
Unbelievable, she muttered.
What?
I immediately asked.
It was simple reflex.
But she wasn't talking to me. Just Crespin.
And as he stared back at her, he did something I'd yet to see him do.
He smiled.
Karcher to Brennan or Brennan to Karcher? He asked.
Both,
said Valerie. I'd had enough of feeling like the odd man out. Maybe one of you can tell me what's going on?
Sure, said Crespin. But first, I have to ask you something. How good are you at pretending you're drunk?
Chapter 92.
What are you having? Asked the bartender.
Second thoughts, I was tempted to say. Instead, double Johnny Black on the rocks, I told him. This one drink would be my prop. A big old glass of whiskey in an unsteady hand to suggest that I'd had plenty more where that came from. The fact that I was already looking pretty ragged from raw nerves and lack of sleep would only add to the effect.
What had Brennan said to his guests on the patio? His quote from Will Rogers.
You never get a second chance to make a good first impression.
It wasn't quite as catchy, but Jeffrey Crespin had his own saying for what I was about to do.
You only get one shot at this man, so I'll ask you a second time. Are you sure you're up for it?
Absolutely, I lied.
From my end seat at the bar in a place called Shadows in Georgetown, it wasn't Brennan I was waiting for. As hangouts go, this was hardly his scene. Hip and chic, all right, but not enough power brokers. Law students instead of lawyers, congressional staffers instead of congressmen. Plus way too many Eurotrash guys with one too many shirt buttons undone. Maybe that was why Shahid Aldasari had chosen the place, the international flavor. That and the de rigueur, dark and sexy lounge lighting. Shadows was clearly saving the owners a ton of money on their electric bill. All that mattered, though, was that the choice was Aldasari's. He'd picked the location. He might have gotten suspicious had Valerie led him there. Excuse me, had Beverly Sands led him there. At the 20-minute mark, I checked the same prepaid cell I'd used at Brennan's house to see if there was any follow-up from Valerie. Word of a delay, or even a change of venue. Neither, though. No new texts. Finally, about a half hour after Valerie had first sent me the address, I looked up to see her walking in with him. Right away, I could tell he was really getting off on watching the other men jealously checking out his date.
Yeah, that's right, boys. She's with me.
Tick-tock. Valerie had only an hour after leaving NSA headquarters to get dolled up again as Beverly. This after initially telling Aldasari that she had a previous engagement after Brennan's party. No wonder the guy was smiling like the devil. This surprise nightcap was the next best thing to a booty call. And undoubtedly, in his eyes, the night was still young.
How was Valerie handling that, I wondered?
After all, Aldasari had to have certain expectations by this point. Would she ever take one for the team, so to speak, like Joan did on Mad Men? No, she'd never. She couldn't, right? For Christ's sake, man, let's keep the focus. As they passed the bar, I bent down to pick up something I'd pretended to drop. When I straightened up,
I glanced over my shoulder to see them grabbing a booth in the back, all according to plan. Give them a little time to settle in with their bottle of champagne, nice and relaxed, and then...
Hey!
I blurted out, stopping in front of their booth with a double take.
It's Annie Oakley!
For good measure, I raised my arms as if shooting a shotgun, spilling some of my drink in the process. I watched as Valerie pretended not to recognize me at first. Aldassari, on the other hand, wasn't pretending. All the better.
Remember?
I said.
We met earlier today at Josiah Brennan's little soiree. Trevor Mann? The Times?
Oh, of course, said Aldassari, sliding out of the booth to shake my hand. Nice to see you again. If that were only true. His pained expression was practically screaming, of all the damn bars in this town, you had to be in this one? Drunk, no less? Make that very drunk. I turned back to Valerie.
Hey, really, nice shooting today. Just excellent, I said. Wait, what's your name again?
Beverly, she said. Beverly Sands.
That's right, of course. And I'm Trevor Mann.
Yes, I believe you said that already. Beverly nodded toward my drink with a patient smile. Are we celebrating something, Mr. Mann?
Ha! More like commiserating, I'm afraid. Problem is, I'm down here in D.C. by myself, so I've no one to commiserate with.
Well, I'm told I'm a good listener, she said. God, she's good at this. She makes it look so effortless.
Oh, it's nothing,
I said with a sloppy wave of my hand.
I mean, it's something. But I really shouldn't say anything.
Yes, that's probably best, said Beverly. With that, I tossed back the rest of my whiskey as if it were liquid courage. No, better yet, a truth serum.
On second thought, what the hell? It's going to be in all the headlines soon enough,
I said before leaning in to whisper.
Can you two keep a secret?
Chapter 93. It was almost too easy, like pushing a big button. Suddenly, Shahid Aldassari wasn't so eager for me to get lost.
Can I buy you another round, Mr. Mann?
And they say women are gossips.
I happily slid into their booth while Aldassari flagged the cocktail waitress.
As I exchanged glances with Valerie, she broke character for a split second to give me a nod.
So far, so good. Now bring it home.
Or at least, that's how I took it.
What were you drinking?
Aldassari asked me as the waitress arrived with pep in her step. She knew a good tip when she saw one.
Double Johnny Black on the rocks,
I said.
Not anymore. Make it a double Johnny Blue, neat, he said.
I was fairly convinced that his cocksure money is no object upgrade was more for Beverly Sands' benefit than mine, but I wasn't about to object. All things considered, if I was pretending to be loaded, it might as well be with top-of-the-line real whiskey.
So where were we? Asked Valerie.
Mr. Mann was about to take us into his confidence, said Aldassari.
First of all, Mr. Mann was my father. Call me Trevor, I said. Second,
I paused for a moment, a la an alcohol-induced memory lapse.
Actually, I can't remember what number two was. But in any event, here's why I'm stuck here in D.C. Of course, it involves politics. Do you guys follow politics?
Sure, a little, said Aldassari. And by a little, it was clear he meant a lot. I let out a deep sigh.
Sorry if this bores you. But apparently, the CIA has invented some new interrogation method that makes waterboarding look like a day at the beach. Problem is, it's killed a bunch of prisoners. Hordes of them. Even bigger problem, at least for the president, is that his new CIA director is involved.
Wait, said Valerie, as if confused. Didn't I see on the news that the new CIA director wasn't going to take the job? I remember because he was standing with his twin daughters, and they were adorable.
That's right. But this is the new CIA director, the one the president is about to announce, I said. That's on the hush-hush, too. I think his name is Archer.
It was probably more from wishful thinking than anything else that I paused for Aldassari to jump in and say, Carter, to correct me. That would be too easy, though. He remained silent as the waitress returned with my 25-year whiskey.
Anyway,
I continued. The Times has the story, and I've been asked to stay down here to do some interviews on the Hill once it breaks on Monday. I grabbed the lowball of Johnny Blue, raising it high.
So, as they say in synchronized swimming, bottoms up.
Beverly Sands lifted her drink to mine with a laugh. Trevor Mann, the reporter from the Times who very possibly had a drinking problem, was nonetheless entertaining. Right, Shahid? She turned to him, her look wondering why he wasn't joining in the cheers. And for the first time, we got a hint of something. He looked distracted, downright uncomfortable. Are you okay? Asked a concerned Beverly Sands. Shahid? Huh? He snapped out of it, raising his champagne. Oh, I'm sorry. Cheers. We clinked glasses, and I waited for some kind of follow-up question from Aldassari. Valerie was waiting too. Maybe he needed a command performance from me to be sure of what he'd heard. Or maybe this was all for naught. The link was only between Karcher and Brennan. And as for Aldassari, he was simply the CIA's patsy, a sort of post-9/11 Lee Harvey Oswald, only in this case, for real. Suddenly, Aldassari began sliding out of the booth. Will you two excuse me for a moment? Chapter 94. Valerie and I both watched as he walked toward the men's room in the back of the bar. We were seeing the same thing. I assumed we were thinking it, too. He's not going to the bathroom, is he? He's calling Brennan, I said. Or maybe even Karcher. One of them, right? Valerie grimaced a twinge of guilt. No, he really is going to the bathroom, she said. In fact, he's going to be in there for a while. That was, you know. She nodded first at his champagne glass and then at her purse. When he stood to shake your hand, she said, it's like liquid X-lax, only a hell of a lot stronger and quicker. Why? I asked. Why would she spike his drink? Technically, it's our third date, she said. In Shahid's mind, it doesn't end with us playing boggle. This way, he won't even want a peck on the cheek. I was wondering about that, I said. You know, up shot one of her eyebrows, whether I'd ever have sex with a mark. Do you guys really call them marks? Yeah, strange, right? Targets of an undercover sting operation never caught on.
So you really haven't...
Is that really only your second whiskey? Sorry, I was just curious. For the record, the answer's no, she said. Not to say he didn't try on dates one and two, but love of my country only goes so far. The cocktail waitress returned to pour some more champagne. Valerie quickly placed her hand over Aldassari's glass. I think he's done for the night, she said politely. I glanced toward the back of the bar as the waitress walked away. What happens now? I asked. The plan she and Crespin had concocted only got me to the table. What happens now is that you tell me who your silent partner is, she said. I know what you meant. I also know that whoever this guy is, he's CIA, or perhaps ex-CIA at this point. There's no other way you could have those recordings.
No other way?
Prove me wrong. If you know he's CIA, what difference does his name make right now? Valerie eyed me for a moment. We'd known each other for less than a day, but it was hard to ignore a certain foxhole mentality. Like it or not, we were in this together. You want trust? I'll give you trust, she said. Remember when Crespin and I looked at each other during one of your recordings? Yes, you tried to pretend it was nothing, but it was obviously something, you're right, she said. Thing is, it was Karcher who initially tipped us off about our man on the toilet right now, that he was funding a known terrorist. So I became Beverly Sands to cozy up to Shahid Aldassari, and lo and behold, we just confirmed it. Shahid's money has been moving in and out of an Al-Qaeda operative's account as recently as last week. Bingo, right? Except for one problem. According to one of your videos and the date stamped on the bottom of the screen, that operative has been dead for over a year. Sometimes you just say the first words that come to your mind, no matter how trite. Holy shit. That's right. Holy shit, she said. Pretty goddamn brilliant, too. Developing that truth serum takes big bucks, and it's not like the CIA can go to Congress for it. So what does Karcher do? He uses the hotshot lawyer, Brennan, to make it look like one of his clients is funding a terrorist with Saudi money. Instead,
what Karcher's really doing is funding himself. But Aldessari would have to know, right? It would seem that way. That's the part I don't get, then, I said. Wouldn't Karcher be throwing Aldessari under the bus? Without the recordings from the Black Site, you guys would still have Aldessari on funding terrorism. Yeah, that's the brilliant part. All the NSA does is provide the proof. Then we hand everything, including Aldessari, back over to Karcher, she said. The CIA will take it from here, he'll tell us, and then it's out of our hands. Then what, though? I asked. It's not like Karcher can't drop the ball. No, of course not. A few months from now, we'd probably hear that Aldessari has flipped and is now Karcher's newest mole in the Middle East, or something like that. And we'd believe it, too, because we'd have no reason not to. But now you do. Which brings me back to your friend, she said. As much as you need to trust me, I need to trust him. And I can't do that if I don't meet him. So tonight, literally, I need you to bring me back to your friend. What about your date? I asked. We can't just leave him. Oh, no? Already she was halfway out the booth. When he's finally able to leave the bathroom, the last thing he'll want to do is explain what took him so long. Trust me, she said. We're doing him a favor. Chapter 95. In 2 minutes flat, we were in the back seat of a DC cab heading off the Beltway past Dulles Airport and out to Arcola. I really should have gotten a to-go cup for that Johnny Walker Blue. The driver, whose disposition most closely resembled an ingrown toenail, initially told us that Arcola was out of his territory, especially after midnight. A crisp Ben Franklin later, he suddenly had a brand new territory. Money is the biggest button of them all. Inside or outside doors? Asked Valerie. I turned to her. Inside or outside? My mother was afraid to fly when I was a kid, so we drove everywhere for vacation. She had this thing, though. We could never stay in a hotel with doors that faced outside, she said. Too dangerous. By any chance, does your mother know what you currently do for a living? I asked. If she were still alive, she wouldn't like it. I'm sorry, I didn't realize. Cervical cancer, when I was in high school, she explained. And since we're in the sympathy card aisle, my father then died of lung cancer during my senior year in college. Jesus. Tell me about it. Of course, if they were both still alive, it's not like I could actually tell them what I do. And what is that exactly? I mean, of all the NSA secrets that Edward Snowden leaked, I didn't hear anything about agents like you. Yeah, little Eddie really complicated things, didn't he? I waited for Valerie to keep talking and perhaps answer my question. She did neither. You're not going to tell me, are you? She smiled. We have to keep some mystery between us, don't we? I practically froze. That was exactly what Claire had said to me the night she was killed. What? Asked Valerie. What did I say? Nothing, I finally answered. But she, too, knew the sound of that nothing. The look she gave me. Still, she let it go. A touch of woman's intuition, perhaps. Regardless, the next few minutes, for me, were inevitable. Memories of Claire came like clicks on the meter in the taxi, one after another, especially from our last moments together. It's often asked, if you knew this was your last night on Earth, what would you do? Had that night with Claire been my last night, though, there was nothing I would have changed. Well, almost nothing. I would have never let Claire go. Front or back? Asked the driver. The question snapped me out of it as I looked up to see him pulling into the Comforter Motel. Staring at the nearly empty parking lot, it was easy to wonder if the no in the no vacancy sign had ever been illuminated. The back, I said. As he pulled around, I went over the ground rules with Valerie again regarding Owen. We'd gotten pretty good at cutting deals on the fly. I go up and explain the situation. Tell him you're here waiting in the taxi, I said. Then I wave you up, okay?
Whoa, excuse me? Blurted out the driver.
I'd forgotten about the other dealmaker among us. He wasn't liking the way his end was shaking out. Is there a problem? I asked.
You're only paying me to drive you here, he said. That's the problem.
I reached into my pocket again for more cash, but Valerie stopped me, reaching into her own pocket. She'd had enough of this guy. Money may talk, but a badge shuts them up every time. Let's try this again, she said.
Is there a problem?
She was holding her badge so close to his eyes she was practically slapping his face with it. With a slow shake of his head, he got with the program. No problem. You can park over at the end there, I said, pointing to an area near a set of stairs. There was no other sound beyond the engine idling as I stepped out to the back lot and made my way up to the second floor, or the penthouse, as Owen jokingly called it. We had the first room off the stairs, as well as the one next to it with a connecting door. Once again, the two-room strategy. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Key card in hand, I eyed the lipstick camera Owen had taped above the sign for the vending machines about 20 feet away. Then came the last safeguard, the knocking sequence to ensure we were truly alone. I suppose I was fudging that one a bit. Two knocks, followed by one, followed by two. The area code of Manhattan. There's no place like home. Less than a minute later, though, I was back down at the taxi. From the look on my face alone, Valerie knew we had a problem. It was the kind no badge could solve. What is it? She asked. That was part of the problem. I wasn't sure. Chapter 96. Owen was gone. That was the only thing I knew for sure. Both our rooms were empty. Empty of him, at least. Gone, too, was his backpack, his bag of tricks. But my duffel was right where I'd left it in one of the closets, everything still inside. My guns, the extra cash. In fact, everything else in the room looked normal. Did they kidnap the maid, too? Asked Valerie, standing in the doorway. Okay, I said normal, not clean. You put two guys in a hotel on the lam for a few days, and it isn't going to be pretty. But that was the question, wasn't it? Had Owen been taken? Or had he left on his own? There was a mobile station with a convenience mart a half mile down the road where we'd been picking up some snacks, but the chances of his taking the walk at 1 o'clock in the morning seemed remote. Where are you going? I asked Valerie. She was headed back out the door, her gun drawn. We start with the perimeter, she said. I understood. Standard police procedure. Start from the outside, in this case literally, and work your way in. His name's Owen, I said. What about a last name? I must have looked like a stumped contestant on a game show. All this time together, and I'd never found out his last name. Huh? Was all I managed. Don't worry about it, she said, turning again to leave. Wait, don't you want to know what he looks like? She stopped just long enough to make me realize that while trust was one thing, the whole truth was another. He's tall, slender, with brown hair, shaggy. Does this with his hands from time to time, she said, doing a perfect imitation of his dry wash routine. Oh, and for the record, his last name is Lewis. She walked out. I stood there in shock, wondering how Valerie knew all that, and equally confounding why she hadn't just told me in the first place. There were no quick answers. What there was, though, was something in my eyeline. Owen's laptop. He had it linked to the lipstick camera outside, our makeshift surveillance system. Since the moment he'd first hooked it up, it had been sitting atop the crappy-looking credenza featuring the TV, plastic ice bucket, and the yellow pages. Now the laptop was in the middle of the queen bed closer to the bathroom. I mean, right in the middle. As if the bed were its pedestal. The only thing missing was the neon sign over it that was blinking, "Look at me, Trevor!" I walked over and tapped the spacebar, waking up the screen. I expected to see the same running image that had been there for days, the walkway outside both our rooms. Only now, there was something in front of it. A picture. No, make that a message. But only for me. In a pop-up window was an illustration off Google Images, one of those goofy clip art signs that read, "Gone fishing." Now I just had to figure out what it was supposed to mean. Fishing for what? What are you looking at? Came Valerie's voice by the door. She was back. I had a split second to make a decision. Given our track record, telling her it was nothing was off the table. It had to be something. But did it have to be the whole truth? This trust thing was getting a bit tricky. Behind you, I said. That's what I'm looking at. I spun the laptop around, but not before clicking the illustration closed. What remained was the feed from the outside camera. Clever, she said, tracing the angle to the sign to the vending machines.
Owen's doing, I assume? It seems you'd know that even better than me, I said. That got me a smirk, but nothing more. She was far more concerned with taking one more lap around both rooms to see if there was something she'd missed the first time. There wasn't. All right, grab your stuff, she said. Let's get going.
Going?
You didn't still think you'd be staying here, did you? Actually, I hadn't thought anything. But Valerie obviously had.
Where are we going? I asked.
Someplace with inside doors, she said. Chapter 97.
Good morning, Mr. Man. How did you sleep?
Asked Jeffrey Crespin, my human alarm clock. He'd taken it upon himself to shake me awake at 6 a.m.
How did I sleep? It's the crack of dawn.
Sparingly, I was tempted to answer, but it was too early and I was too tired for glibness.
Fine,
I said instead. He was sitting on a folding metal chair at the end of my cot, wearing a blue blazer and jeans. I guess the jeans were how he unwound on a Sunday.
Would you like some coffee? He asked.
I looked over his shoulder to see Valerie in the doorway, taking a sip from a mug, the string from a tea bag hanging over the edge. She was wearing the same Beverly Sands outfit she'd had on 4 hours ago, which answered the question of where she'd spent the night. It was here. Wherever the hell that might be. Not only didn't I know, I was never supposed to know. Hence the Bruce Wayne and Batcave routine after leaving the motel in Arcola. Valerie'd had the taxi take us to an underground parking garage in Fort Meade, where we got into an unmarked van, but only after she put a sack over my head. For real. Then again, I guess that's why they call it a safe house.
Yeah, some coffee would be good, I said. Cream if you have it, no sugar.
I'll see what they have, said Valerie, before disappearing into the hallway. Crespin leaned back in his chair, crossing his legs.
I suppose there's also tea, but I figured you more for coffee, he said.
You figured right.
Funny thing, though. Do you know who never drinks coffee?
I give up.
Frank Karcher.
I immediately liked where this was going, and Crispin could tell. For only the second time, I saw him smile.
Aldassari called him?
Late last night, he said. When he was finally feeling better, I presume.
What did he say?
Everything you told him at the bar.
But as soon as he heard my name,
that was the best part. You'd think Karcher would have told Aldassari he'd been played by you, but he didn't. He just thanked him for the heads up.
It actually makes sense, I said. Karcher knows I don't work for the Times. The paper doesn't have the story.
And speaking of stories that aren't real,
of course. Aldassari must have told Karcher how he first met me.
Exactly, he said. After Karcher hung up from Aldassari, he immediately woke up Brennan. Naturally, Brennan makes sure to call him right back from the secure line in his study.
Only thanks to Valerie's handiwork, the NSA could listen in on that conversation, too.
I can only imagine Brennan's reaction, I said.
To tell you the truth, I think he was more upset about not actually being interviewed for the Times than he was at the prospect of spending the next 10 to 15 years folding laundry.
That's a lawyer for you, I said.
Prison is what happens to other people. We'll see. In the meantime, nice work last night. Valerie tells me you play an excellent drunk.
I've had some practice.
She also told me about Owen, that he's suddenly gone missing.
First things first, if you don't mind. Why didn't you guys just tell me you knew who he was? Crespin didn't hesitate.
When gauging an asset, it's always good to know up front if what he's telling you is true. I take it I'm the so-called asset in that sentence. It's just the way we do things.
So you can probably guess my next question.
Yes, he said. But the answer to that one makes things a little trickier.
Chapter 98. A little trickier? Did he really just say that? I'd spent the night, what was left of it, sleeping in the NSA's version of inside doors. I was in a safe house somewhere in D.C. on the heels of a road trip taken with a boy genius from the CIA who thought he was curing Alzheimer's, only to discover he was really helping to create what would have been the ultimate interrogation tool if it weren't for the fact that it happened to have a fail rate of 40%. And by fail, I mean fatally. which would explain why the men responsible for all this were going to such extreme lengths to ensure they were never found out. And by extreme, I also mean fatally. But now, so I was being told, things were about to get, wait for it, a little trickier. I stared back at Crespin. No, it's actually simple, I said. You either can or can't tell me how you know about Owen. I admire that, I really do, he said, once again without any hesitation. Despite everything you've been through, you're still capable of seeing the world in black and white. Not everything is gray. He cocked his head. Look around you, Mr. Man. I was surrounded by cinder block walls and concrete floors. There was the metal chair Crespin was sitting in, as well as my metal cot. Even the blanket I'd been given, all gray. And Crespin wasn't even being literal. Are you trying to change the subject? I asked. No, I'm only giving it perspective, he said. I know about Owen Lewis because of your friend Claire Parker. He looked at me as if he'd just thrown a verbal grenade into our conversation. But I wasn't sure why. After all, I also know about Owen Lewis because of Claire Parker, I said. Yes, I realize that. So now comes that trickier part I promised you. He uncrossed his legs, his back straightening. Claire worked for the NSA. Kaboom. It was as if all the blood had been suddenly flushed from my head. I felt dizzy, the room spinning, a big gray blur. Excuse me? I said. I don't think I need to say it again. No, he didn't. To be very clear, Claire was everything you thought she was, a national affairs reporter for the New York Times. She was a gifted journalist who only wrote the truth. But as I'm sure you're aware, doing that, especially doing it at her level, takes sources. You were one of her sources? No, not me personally. Someone else within the NSA. The division is called Tailored Access Operations, if that means anything. And in return? You mean, what did she do for them? Give something, get something, right? Not exactly, he said. At least, not in the way you're worried about. I think you know that Claire would never burn any of her sources. That's not what she did for us. Then what exactly did she do? Before Crespin could answer, though, we were both looking at Valerie, leaning against the doorway again. She was back. In one hand was a piece of paper, in the other, a laptop. So much for a cup of coffee. You need to see something, she said. Chapter 99. I assumed she was talking only to Crespin, especially when she walked right past me to hand him the piece of paper. He read it, glanced up at Valerie, and read it again. Instead of handing it back to her, however, he handed it to me. The reason was as clear as the email address in the upper left-hand corner. It was mine. I was looking at a printout of an email sent to me by Brennan, except I'd never seen it before. That was when I noticed the timestamp, 5:34 a.m. Brennan had only sent it a half hour earlier. Trevor, change of venue for our interview today, if that's okay. Too many distractions here at house. Mallard Cafe at 33rd and Prospect at 11. They do a mean Sunday brunch. J.B. There's your answer, by the way, said Crespin. Answer to what? What was the question? I asked. What Claire did for us, he said. You're looking at it. That hardly cleared up anything, and he knew it. The guy had coy down to a science. Valerie to the rescue. Josiah Brennan didn't send the email, she explained. I looked down again at the paper. There was Brennan's email address underneath mine, the same address he'd been using since first confirming our supposed interview. If he didn't send it, who did? I asked. But I already knew the answer before the words had even left my mouth. Karcher? Yes, said Crespin. And Brennan has no idea. How do you know? Karcher used a certain spyware virus. As soon as you read an email from him, he can then assume your identity, basically controlling your entire email account. The reason we know this is because we use the same virus. I still don't get the connection to Claire, I said. Valerie looked over at Crespin as if to say, Go ahead, boss. You're the one who brought it up. Crespin thought for a moment. Finally, Imagine you're in London to interview a certain cleric before he's deported from the UK to Jordan, he said. The cleric has little trust in an American journalist, or any American for that matter, but he's eager to speak his mind. The international stage can be intoxicating, and no one serves up the limelight better than the New York Times. A neutral location is agreed upon, almost always a hotel, and the cleric has one of his body men search you even though they're not quite sure what they're looking for. A recording device? It's an interview. Of course you have a recorder. And as far as they can tell, it looks exactly like any other recorder they've ever seen. But it's not, I said. No. Instead, it hacks the hotel's internet service and then hacks the cleric's cell phone. And here's the key. It does all of it wirelessly. Which means Claire didn't really have to do a thing. Except give her consent, I said, unable to hold back my smirk. Crespin nodded. But this wasn't just any cleric, was it? No, it wasn't. This was a guy who'd been jailed repeatedly in London without ever receiving a trial. Over a bottle of Brunello one night, Claire had argued with me that he deserved one, and I'd argued back that according to the anti-terrorism laws passed in Britain after 9/11, he didn't. This was the night before she flew to London to interview him. Here, said Valerie, giving me the laptop in her other hand. You need to log on to your email and cancel on Brennan. Cancel? Unless, of course, you'd prefer your last meal to be Eggs Benedict. This is Karcher setting you up, she said. Yes, the same Karcher responsible for Claire's death, I shot back. Forgive me for sounding a little testy. Listen, I get it, said Valerie. You want revenge, who wouldn't? But this isn't you pretending to be drunk with some jet-set skirt-chasing international playboy. This is a guy who wants to kill you. Which is exactly why I'll be at the Mallard Cafe at 11 o'clock, I said, as sure as I'd ever been about anything in my life. Karcher wants to kill me? All right. But he can't. He won't. At least not right away. And that's an opportunity we can't pass up. I was ready to explain, to argue my case, yell and scream if I had to. But I didn't have to. Valerie and Crespin both had that look on their faces, the kind I used to see on juries during the closing argument of every case I'd ever won. It was as if I knew exactly what they were thinking. This guy might actually have a point. Now all we needed was a plan. Chapter 100. Can I get you anything while you're waiting? Asked the waitress, a quick tilt of her head acknowledging the empty chair across from me. Her name tag read Betsy. If there had been more time, more options, more everything, this young woman with rolled-up sleeves would have been Valerie undercover, and in addition to having her hair tucked into a ponytail, she would have had a beretta tucked behind the white apron with the big green M that all the servers at the Mallard Cafe wore. But sometimes you just have to make do. I'm good for now, I said. Thanks, though. This was clearly music to Betsy's ears. One less thing she had to do. My very real waitress had that harried look of having a few too many tables in her section. As far as I could tell, she was the only one tending to all the outdoor seating that lined the front of the cafe. Betsy shuffled off while I kept waiting. Not that I'd expected to be doing anything different. Karcher would absolutely make sure I arrived first. After that, it was anyone's guess, including whether it would even be Karcher who showed. The guy had a history of letting others do his dirty work. Stop fidgeting, came a voice in my ear. I mean, literally in my ear. Crespin had outfitted me with what had to be the world's tiniest transmitter, smaller than the head of a tack. It was fully out of sight inside my ear canal. Sorry, I said, only to realize that I'd just broken one of his two rules. What did I tell you about talking to me? Came his voice again. And don't answer that. Rule number one, don't talk into the mic. Otherwise known as the third button down on my new NSA brand shirt. 50% cotton poly blend with a 500-foot range. If Karcher, or whoever he might send, was scouting me, I could ill afford to be seen talking to myself. The wire was so Crespin could hear what I heard. It's going to be fine, man, he was now assuring me. Everything's going to be... The way his voice suddenly cut out, my first thought was that the transmitter in my ear had failed. But Crespin was just seeing what I couldn't. Don't turn around, don't even flinch, he said. He's approaching you from behind at 20 feet, 15, 10. A voice boomed over my shoulder.
Is this seat taken?
It was now. Frank Karcher sat down before I could even look up. Jesus, he had a big head. It was even bigger in person. I feigned surprise as best I could. I was supposed to be waiting for Brennan, after all. Excuse me, I think you have the wrong table, I said. Karcher broke into a wide grin.
No, this is definitely the right table. You just picked the wrong fight, he said, glancing at his watch. The only question now is how long you'll pretend you don't know what I'm talking about.
Said question hung in the air as I pretended to be thinking it over. But I already knew my answer. So far, we were right on script. I know exactly what you're talking about, I said finally. I know who you are and what you've done. I also know it's all about to end. Again with the grin. Those had to be veneers.
Interesting choice of words, he said. Do me a favor, though, will you, Mr. Man? Take a good look under the table.
I don't need to, I said. You're not the first person this week to point a gun at me.
You're right, he said. But I am the last.
Chapter 101. It was my turn to smile, forced and short-lived as the smile was. You can only pretend for so long that you don't have a gun aimed at your crotch. If the only thing you wanted was me dead, you would have killed me by now, I said. We both know that. And there it was. The only way I'd been able to convince Valerie and Crespin that I wouldn't be a complete sitting duck, if you will, at the Mallard Cafe. Karcher desperately wanted Owen, the kid, and I presumably knew where he was. Fitting irony that I actually didn't. Not that Karcher was about to be told that. As long as he thought I knew Owen's whereabouts, he believed there was the chance he could get it out of me. That's the folly of arrogant men, isn't it? They always overestimate their talents.
Are you really that much of a hero, Mr. Man? He asked. I don't know what the kid told you, but it's not what you think.
No, it's exactly what I think, I said. Somewhere along the line, you convinced yourself that you're above the law, that you get to decide who lives and who dies. But the biggest lie of them all? It's when you claim you're simply protecting freedom.
Freedom? Because where the hell have you been this century? We should be so damn lucky, he said. That's what you self-righteous pricks have never understood. Not ever.
Then why don't you enlighten me?
Why don't you shut the fuck up?
Easy now, came Crespin's voice in my ear. Crespin was right. On a risk scale of 1 to 10, I was already pushing 11. My letting Karcher lose his temper was upward of just plain dumb. Sure, maybe he'd slip up and admit everything, or maybe he'd just get pissed off and kill me right there at the table. I leaned back in my chair, hoping to let a little air out of the moment, diffuse the tension. But it was too late. Karcher was revved up, and like a pit bull, he wasn't about to let the point go.
Do you know what I remember most about that day? It's not the image of the towers coming down, not even close. What's seared into my brain, what will stick forever, are the people on the street watching it happen, he said. And do you know what they were all doing as they were looking up in horror? They were all mouthing the same three words. Oh my God.
I was one of those people, I said. I was there. It was as if he didn't hear me.
Now, I'm a devout Christian, but I know for a fact that the God they were all invoking that day wasn't there. And for those who say he was, and that his job is not to intervene, I ask, whose job is it? If God won't prevent the next time, who will? And trust me, there will be a next time.
So that's it then, I said. You're now God's understudy? It doesn't matter who you kill, a reporter for the Times, a doctor with a guilty conscience, or even other people from your company picnic. Because it's all part of a bigger plan. One that the rest of us couldn't possibly understand.
Every war has casualties, Mr. Man. But I'm guessing you've never fought in one, have you?
That makes me lucky, not brain dead, I said. What's your excuse?
Damn. Wrong button.
Karcher's face flushed red in an instant, the veins in his stump-like neck bulging out above his collar.
You know what? Fuck the kid, he said. I don't care if you know where he is. You can take that to your goddamn grave.
but all I really heard was Crespin's panicked voice in my ear.
Quick, tell him you know where Owen is.
Crespin didn't need to see the deranged look in Karcher's eyes. He could hear the craziness in his voice, the way he referred to my grave as if it were imminent. I needed to stall. But again, it was too late. With the slightest flinch, small but telling, I'd just broken Crespin's second rule. Whatever you do, don't look like you've got someone talking in your ear.
Jesus Christ, said Karcher. You're not alone, are you?
Chapter 102. No, he's definitely not alone, she said. I turned to see Valerie pulling up a chair to our table. She couldn't play the waitress, but her being seated nearby was the next best thing. And with her mirrored sunglasses and jet black wig, there was no way Karcher would have recognized her. He still didn't. The Beretta in her lap, however, he spotted instantly, and it sure as hell wasn't pointed at me. Give the prick some credit, though. Karcher barely blinked.
Friend of yours, Mr. Mann?
He asked coolly. One of many, said Valerie, which is why you need to wrap your weapon in that napkin and place it slowly on the table. Karcher looked down at the napkin in front of him like it was a piece of enriched plutonium. He had no intention of touching it.
Thank you for the suggestion, young lady, but I think I'll pass, he said. It might be a good idea for you to do it, though.
Those should have been the words of a madman, a last-ditch effort to buy some time in this chess match, using little more than misdirection and a touch of outright confusion. Call it Karcher's gambit. But the tone was more cocky than confused. He was too sure of himself. He knew something we didn't, and I couldn't stop the feeling of pure dread that was suddenly spreading from the pit of my stomach. I looked at Valerie, and for the first time, she took her eyes off Karcher to look back at me, if only for a split second. But that was all the time it took. Shit, she muttered. Karcher smiled.
Looks like I've got some friends, too, he said.
Show him, came Crespin's voice in my ear. Only he wasn't talking to me. Valerie was wearing the same transmitter. With her eyes locked back on Karcher, she removed her sunglasses so I could see what the hell was going on. Shit, I muttered. Staring back at me in the mirrored lenses was a new addition to my forehead. The small red dot of a laser sight. I was one squeeze of a trigger away from having my brains blown out, which somehow managed to trump getting shot in the crotch. Either way, it was suddenly a lose-lose. We were definitely off script now.
I know you, don't I?
Asked Karcher, staring straight back into Valerie's naked eyes. Maybe, she answered. Or maybe not. But I definitely know you.
What about Mr. Mann here? He said. How much do you really know about him?
Enough to be sitting here, she said.
Keep stalling him,
came Crespin's voice in our ears. I suppose you know more, though, Valerie tacked on.
He shot a federal agent in Manhattan, for starters, and got a detective up there killed as well.
Karcher looked at me to see if I'd take the bait and try to argue otherwise. All along, he'd been defending himself without admitting to anything. Now he was hoping I'd trip myself up in the heat of the moment, so he could build some semblance of reasonable doubt. But I gave him the best comeback I could. Silence. Not Valerie, though. What about outstanding parking tickets? She deadpanned. Does he have any of those as well?
No, but he does have a dead guy in his bathtub. I forgot to mention that,
Karcher said, his voice tinged with what could only be described as glee. Extra creepy on a guy his size.
The police searched his apartment yesterday.
You know, if there was only some way I knew you were telling the truth, some type of method, she said, wouldn't that be something? I mean, what wouldn't we all give for that? Karcher deflected her with a chuckle, but it was quickly drowned out by something else I was hearing. My head was suddenly filled with footsteps, only they were more than steps. They were strides. Crespin was running, his breathing heavy as if he were in a full sprint. I knew Valerie could hear it too, but she kept right on talking to Karcher, stalling him. Then out of the corner of my eye, I saw something that I really, truly wished I hadn't. Chapter 103. No, no, no! I wanted so desperately to signal her somehow, wave my hand and tell her she had to stop. But I was helpless. I knew I couldn't. It would be like yanking the pin on a grenade. The waitress, Betsy, ponytail and rolled up sleeves. She was heading to our table. "Huh, looks like we have a party of three," she said, pulling up between Karcher and Valerie. She was half distracted, clutching her order pad while searching for a pen in the deep pocket of her apron. "If you'd like, I can move you all to another table." "No, that's okay. I was just saying hello to these guys," said Valerie, flashing a polite smile. "I'll be getting up in a few seconds." But from the moment I felt the tap on my foot underneath the table, I realized this wasn't just a figure of speech. Valerie was giving me a signal. In a few seconds, she really was getting up, and the reason was right in front of me, literally. Our waitress, Betsy, was directly in the line of fire. I stole a peek at Valerie's sunglasses now folded on the table, the lenses angled up toward my face. The only question was whether or not Karcher had noticed too. Asked and answered. Karcher's eyes lit up as he glanced at me. He saw it, or rather, he didn't see it. The red dot on me from the laser sight was gone, blocked by the, "Now!" yelled Valerie. She had Karcher in no man's land, his hand swinging. For a fraction of a second, he was undecided where to aim his gun. A hell of a lot can happen in a fraction of a second. Valerie lunged for Karcher as I sprang from my chair, the sound of Crespin in my ears still sprinting, matching the pounding of my heart. Betsy had no idea what was happening. She immediately jumped back based on nothing but reflex and fear of the unknown. I was heading right for her, no stopping, the M on her apron, the target of my dive. I could feel the wind being knocked out of her as I tackled her to the ground, the crack of a rifle shot from only God knows where splitting the air above us. But nothing more. Small comfort. Oswald's first shot in Dealey Plaza missed too. I turned my head, looking up to see Valerie still struggling with Karcher, each with a hand on the other's gun. He outweighed her by nearly 100 pounds, but she'd gotten to her feet first and had the leverage. For how long, though? "Stay down," I barked at Betsy, as if there were a chance in the world she was about to get up. No, that was my job now. Palms down, I began to push off the ground, my eyes trained on Karcher. His face and neck were a mishmash of muscle and tendon straining for all the strength he had. Slowly, his gun was moving back toward Valerie. She had about 6 inches to live. That was when I saw it. The only thing that could make things worse. And only one word came to mind to warn her. "Red!" I yelled. I don't know what came next, what I heard or what I saw. But Valerie knew what I meant and knew her geometry. And as the second shot echoed in my ears, I saw her step back and take Karcher with her, the dot jumping from her back to his. The only red now was blood. Lots and lots of it. Karcher fell to the ground face up and only inches from Betsy, who shrieked in horror as she caught sight of the gaping hole in his barrel chest from the exit wound.
"Drop it! Drop your weapon right now!"
Valerie and I turned to each other, and then up to the rooftop down the street. It was Crespin in our ears. He was done running. I don't know if God actually knew where the shots were coming from, but now Crespin did. He'd reached Karcher's sniper.
"I got him. It's over," he said, catching his breath. "It's over."
Of course, if that were only true. Book 5. Truth or Die. Chapter 104. Frank Karcher had been the master of making all sorts of things disappear. People, problems, his moral compass. But the one thing he couldn't cover up was his own death. Instead, others were going to do it for him. At least that was the way it was playing out. There were a dozen witnesses to what happened outside the Mallard Cafe, and they all knew what they'd seen. When the police arrived and a couple of detectives fanned out to ask what had happened, each and every one had an answer. But none of them knew why it had happened. Same for every news outlet that rushed to the scene. Karcher's death was the stuff of headlines and lead stories, but the whole truth hadn't gone public yet. The question now was whether it ever would. I feel like a kid waiting outside the principal's office, I said. Valerie leaned forward, glancing at the closed door to our right. Yeah, and your parents are already in there having the adults-only talk, right?
Exactly.
She nodded. Par for the course, I'm afraid. The only way to know your worth in this town is the level of classified info you're allowed to hear. The whole loaf or just a slice?
Or in my case, only a few crumbs, I said.
Hey, I'm not in there either. That makes us both a couple of muzjiks, she said.
Muzwhats?
Peasants. The word for Russian peasants, actually.
Of course.
Also one of the highest scoring words in Scrabble.
Now you're just showing off, I said.
Scrabble was big in our house growing up. My father played it every Sunday with my sister and me to build our vocabularies, she said. That's one reason why I know the word.
Muzjiks, huh?
Yep. Use it on your first turn, and it's worth 128 points. I waited for her to continue. She didn't.
And a second reason? I asked.
She'd said that was one reason why she knew the word. With the look she gave me, I suddenly realized this wasn't mere idle chit-chat. Valerie was finally answering the question I'd asked when we first met. Who are you? There was no one around us in the hallway. Still, she looked both ways as if crossing the street. I was stationed in Moscow, she said. But the way she said it, I knew.
CIA?
She nodded.
How long ago?
I asked. It feels like forever.
What happened?
Someone decided to tell the world our deepest, darkest secrets because he didn't like the way we got them. Consequences be damned. So that was who she was. Valerie Jensen had been an undercover CIA agent.
And you were exposed?
Hundreds were, all over the world, she said. More than a few were killed, too. Not that it ever made the news. I was lucky. It wasn't like a woman could ever be in Tehran or Kabul.
Still, I said.
Moscow? Putin had never struck me as the forgiving type. Thankfully, money will pretty much get you anything you need there, including a way out through Finland in the middle of the night, she said. Funny, though. After all that, where does our whistleblower first gain asylum?
Russia.
So how did you end up with the NSA? It was a bit like the island of misfit toys. No one else had any use for us. All the covert training and nowhere to use it, she said. Except here at home, of course.
Another thing that will never make the news, I said.
That depends, I suppose.
On what?
On how well you can keep a secret.
I had to laugh.
Imagine that, I said. You're not even the best secret I've got going right now. All the more reason why we're sitting here.
Yep. A couple of muzjiks.
Valerie laughed back, and for a minute it was as if we were able to forget where we were and why.
Actually, it was only like 10 seconds. Right up until the door opened next to us, and an older woman with gray hair stepped out and peered over her horn-rimmed glasses with a perfunctory smile.
She was Clay Dobson's assistant. You two can come in now, she announced. Chapter 105. The only way I ever thought I'd set foot in the White House was on a guided tour with a bunch of people wearing fanny packs. Shuffling along the velvet ropes, I'd stare into all the capital R rooms, the East Room, the State Dining Room, the blue, red, and green rooms decorated by Jackie Kennedy. Still, when the tour was over, the closest I'd ever get to the Oval Office was a postcard in the gift shop. Now I was literally a few feet away from it in the West Wing, the office right next door. The office of the president's chief of staff. And if Owen was right, the man ultimately responsible for the deaths of Claire and our unborn child, as well as countless others. But that was a big if, as in, if only there were some actual evidence.
Ian, do me a favor and scoot over on the couch there for Mr. Mann, said Dobson, orchestrating from behind his huge desk. Make no mistake, this was his office, his meeting, his seating chart. He'd already motioned for Valerie to take the other armchair next to Crespin. Ian, as in Ian Landry, the president's press secretary, promptly scooted over on the couch to make room for me.
There you go, he said. Best seat in the house.
It was a little strange to see Landry out from behind the podium of the Brady Room. To watch him take questions from the press was to know there wasn't anything he couldn't spin, It was a talent all the more remarkable, given that, unlike previous press secretaries, Landry didn't hide behind the facade of plausible deniability. Rather, he'd claimed from day one that he knew everything that happened in the White House. After all, President Breton Morris had won election by promising to level with America at all times. Hard truths and no easy fixes, he was fond of saying in his campaign commercials. And with nearly $1 billion